The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2019 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2019. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
All right, good afternoon. Let me start by saying thank you very much for attending this. Hopefully it'll be worth your while. If not, you can complain after I'm done. Take a look at this picture. Isn't it amazing? Can anyone recognize this story at all? Do you want to call it out? Well, the illustrator for this is a lady named Laurel Long. She does some incredible work, and this is her illustrated work of The Lady and the Lion. You can see the lady on the back of the griffin there. You can see the lion here off to the right-hand side. But talk about just images, traditional images that are in, you know, great fairy tales. You have a lion, which a few of us talked about that last night. You have a griffin from this kind of a mythological character. But then you have the dragon, and which is a traditional image of evil, actually. At least it was up until a few decades ago, and now we have Shrek, and we have How to Train Your Dragon. We've lost this image of evil. That was a wonderful image of evil in these stories. You can see it in Laurel Long's work. I wasn't even planning to talk about that, but I was once again just struck by that image. It's beautiful. So The Lady and the Lion, take a look. It's actually... I'm a family treasure of ours, and it looks like I'm going to have a competitor over here, and I plan to win. So if I have to yell, I shall yell. So thanks. We're here to talk about fairy tales, and the title of it is Tales as Old as Time on the Origin, Structure, and Use of Fairy Tales, and I'm going to answer, or I'm going to try to deal with all three of those, but let me start by reading this. These are two paragraphs. Be patient with me. It's not up on the screen. This is not my words, I'm quoting from someone else. I propose to speak of fairy stories, though I'm aware that this is a rash adventure. Fairy is a perilous land. In it are pitfalls for the unwary and dungeons for the overbold. Isn't that a great word? Overbold, cocky, right? And the overbold, I may be accounted. For though I have been a lover of fairy stories since I learned to read and have at times thought about them, I have not studied them professionally. I have been hardly more than a wandering explorer or trespasser in the land, full of wonder, but not of information. And then the next paragraph. The realm of fairy story is wide and deep and high and filled with many things. All manner of beasts and birds are found there. Shoreless seas, stars uncounted, beauty that is an enchantment and an ever-present peril or a danger as well. Both joy and sorrow as sharp as words. In that realm, a man may perhaps count himself fortunate to have wandered. But its very richness and strangeness tie the tongue of a traveler who would report on them. In other words, you get there, you experience it, and you return, and your tongue is tied. And while he is there, it is dangerous for him to ask too many questions, lest the gates be shut and the keys be lost. Those are the first two paragraphs. Do you know where this is from? This is Tolkien's essay on fairy stories, written in 1939. Believe it or not, before it was an article, it was a speech. It was given as part of the Andrew Lang lectures in Scotland. Every year they have someone come and give lectures in honor of Andrew Lang. Now, does that name sound familiar to you? Yes. So if you read any of the color fairy stories, the blue fairy story, the red fairy, the violet, the yellow, all of those are his work. Actually, that's not exactly true. It's his wife's work. She did a lot of the work collecting and compiling those fairy stories. But Tolkien was asked very late to come and give a lecture on fairy stories, the Andrew Lang lecture in Scotland. And if you know anything about Tolkien and the way he wrote, he took a long time. In fact, we probably wouldn't have had The Lord of the Rings if C.S. Lewis hadn't have come to him, and I'm paraphrasing, finish the thing, right? Without C.S. Lewis, we probably wouldn't have had The Lord of the Rings because he was tinkering. Well, believe it or not, Tolkien wrote this essay very, very quickly and presented it up in Scotland, but he continued to tinker with it for decades afterwards. So if you go and you find a copy of On Fairy Stories, you have to ask, which version are you reading? Because he continued to tinker with it. Now, the main ideas are there. However, he liked to tinker with the examples, adding and taking things away. So I'm going to use this essay in order to talk about fairy stories. And we're going to answer three questions. But before I do, remember in the first paragraph, he says, I'm not a professional here. I just kind of wandered into this world. So I don't know if you want to take anything I have to say too seriously. 24 years later, in an essay on three ways of writing for children in 1963, very, very close to his death, I'm talking about Lewis's death, Lewis said this in this essay. He says, I hope everyone has read Tolkien's essay on fairy tales, which is perhaps the most important contribution to the subject that anyone has yet made. So here's Tolkien saying, you know what, I'm just a casual observer. And he goes on to write one of the greatest essays on a fairy stories. In fact, today, if you do any work on a fairy tales, if you publish anything, you almost have an obligation to make a nod towards Tolkien, to this essay, to say, yes, I've read the essay. Now, let me show you where he's wrong, or let me show you where he didn't go far enough. But you almost have to make a nod. That's the kind of essay that this is. All right, so we're going to use this. And we're actually going to use Tolkien's three questions that he proposes in paragraph three. So we did paragraph one and two. I'm not going to read through the entire essay. It's about 20 pages long, although that might be time well spent. But he proposes three questions here. And these are his, and we're going to use those to talk about fairy stories. So here they are. What is a fairy story? What is their origin, and what is the use of them? In other words, what is this thing we're talking about? Where do they come from, and why should we read them? Right? Do they serve any purpose whatsoever? And he answers all three of these for us. So let's start with what is a fairy story. This is what he says. Okay, that's not going to go well. This is what he says. A fairy story is one which touches on or uses, and then he says it again, but spells it a different way, fairy. In fact, he then cautions us. He says, don't assume that when you have a fairy story that we're talking about fairies, little imps or little creatures that fly around like Tinkerbell. Now, I need to stop and say, Tinkerbell is a pretty good representation of what a fairy is because they're mean. Traditionally, fairies are mean, so we say, oh, it's a fairy. They're nasty. And Tinkerbell's nasty. She hates Wendy, right? But they're nasty little creatures. But his point is this. When we're talking about a fairy story, we're not talking about a story about those little small creatures flying around. Rather, we're talking about this fairy. This is one example of fairy right here. All right, you can see the floating city. Or the floating mountain. This is probably Neverland, right? That's not the Jolly Roger. It's the Ranger, which we could go into that. But you can see it's this fantastic world. This is what Tolkien says. Fairy cannot be caught in a net of words. We should probably just stop there, right? You can't explain it. But he's going to explain what he means by there. For it is one of its qualities to be indescribable, though not imperceptible. All right? It's hard to describe what fairy is, but it doesn't mean you can't perceive it. This is what I tell my students. Have you ever gone outside at nighttime and looked up into the sky, right? It's a clear night, and you look directly at a blank spot up in the sky, and it looks black when you stare right at it, but you look a little bit off to the side, and suddenly you can perceive that there's something there, like a star. Now, there's a physiological reason for that, why our eyes are able to do that, that frankly I'm not interested in right now, right? But we can perceive it even when we're not staring directly at it. That's a related idea. He says it has many ingredients, but analysis will not necessarily discover the secret of the whole. So as I tell my students on the first day of class, now I teach classic children's literature at Hillsdale College. It's mainly I have seniors in this class. And on the first day of class, I usually tell them, listen, the college has spent 4 years training you how to read analytically. You're going to need to put some of those tools away, all right? Because it, not all of them, but some of them. Because when you begin to hack at this thing, this is not a biology laboratory. We're not going to hack this story to pieces. You have to allow the story to work on you. And sometimes that's hard for my students to do. We've trained them well to read analytically. And that's a good thing, right? But some of these stories are not meant to be read that way. He says this, fairy itself may perhaps most nearly be translated by magic. Now, some of us are going to have trouble with that. I grew up in a very strict fundamentalist home. That's the M word, right? But we'll get to it. But it is not the magic of a particular, but it is the a magic of a particular mood or power at the furthest pole, in other words, at the opposite end, from the vulgar devices of the laborious scientific magician. Are you thinking of the same character I'm thinking of? Laborious scientific magician? Let me give you a hint. The word magician's in the title of the book, right? Now, this is C.S. Lewis's character, but I am convinced he had in mind the same idea of the laborious scientific magician, right? What Tolkien is saying here is that when we talk of fairy, we're at the opposite end, right? This kind of a magician, if you know the magician's nephew, Uncle Andrew goes into this magical world of Narnia where he saw a little piece of iron go in the ground and become a lamppost, right? And all he can think about is, think of what we could do with this. We could make tanks, we can make battleships, right? These machines of war. Why? To give him power and to give him money, right? So those kinds of ideas are at the polar opposite end of what Tolkien is talking about here in terms of magic. So what do we mean by magic? Well, if you were at my earlier talk, I referred to this book. Again, I'm going to refer to it again. This is a larger concept, but I think Guroian captures the idea of magic in one little statement. He says this, fairy tale stories project fantastic other worlds. What he means by this is that the natural laws of the material world do not apply. That's why you can see a ship flying in the air. That's why you can see people going against our understanding of the laws of nature in terms of the material world. But he doesn't stop there. So save that in your mind. Those natural laws of the material world do not apply in this perilous realm. But then he says this, but they also pay close attention to real moral laws of character and virtue. So while the laws of the material world are manipulated, the laws of the moral world remain true. He goes on. Fairy tales remind us of moral truths whose ultimate claims of normativity and permanence, we heard about the permanent things at around 8:30 this morning, permanence we would not think of questioning. And he says this, love freely given is a better than obedience that is coerced. Courage that rescues the innocent is noble, whereas cowardice that betrays others for self-gain or self-preservation is worthy of disdain. Those moral laws are the same moral laws that we hold to, that we recognize as the permanent things, even though we see flying ships and flying characters and magical things. So there are things that are different, but there are things that are the same, and the moral law remains the same. All right. So what is a fairy story then? Just to review, a fairy story is a story that touches on fairy, this magical, enchanted realm that allows for the manipulation of these laws. So let's move on. What is their origin? Where do they come from? So Tolkien, in his essay, identifies three origins of these fairy tales. Now, I just drew out some pictures that reminded me of them. The first one here, you can see this young man at the desk with a typewriter who's got this cloud above his head, and he's writing this great story. The first place that these stories come from, Tolkien identified as independent invention. In other words, you sit down, you say, I want to write a story about a knight. And that knight is going to go off, and you come up with your own story. All right, independent invention. It doesn't come from anywhere else. You come up with it on your own. My question is this even possible? Let me give you an example. Again, going back to Narnia. Not all my examples are from Narnia. The White Witch. What an incredible character, a very strong character in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And we see her also in The Magician's Nephew as well. But how about this character? Have we seen this character before? Well, Lewis never admitted to it. He never said, no, I got this from another thing. But she's very eerily similar to the Snow Queen. And we do know that Tolkien read Hans Christian Andersen quite a bit. Even these images, look, you can see the White Witch and Edmund down there. You can see the Snow Queen with Kay down there. They're both trying to lure him for their own purposes. Now, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this, but let me just throw out a question. Those of you who know the Snow Queen, okay, let me back up. The White Witch, clearly she is evil, right? She's the personification of evil. She's wicked in every way. How about the Snow Queen? Is she truly evil? Oftentimes we read this story and we think, oh, of course she's evil. But is she? If you know the story well, you know that towards the end of the story, we discover she lives up in the north and she lives on a lake of clear glass. Do you know what the glass is called? It's called the Mirror of Reason. And then she says it's the queen claims it's the only mirror that matters in the world. All right? Does she truly represent evil, or does she represent something else? So that's just something to leave. If you haven't read Snow Queen before, now you can read it with thinking, is she truly evil? So there's similarities and there's a little bit of differences as well. So the first one was independent invention. I'm skeptical of that. Can you really sit down and close out everything that you don't, that you've seen and you know, and come up with a truly original story? If you heard me speak earlier today, I have a firm belief in the idea of the imagination, this collection of images. And I don't think we can run from those images. And I think those images inform the stories that we create. So possibility number two is this right here. You see this old man telling stories to these children. You see the old lady off in the corner. She's probably preparing food or something like that. But you can see the kids around listening to the story of the old man. Tolkien would call this inheritance. Passing stories on from generation to generation to generation. I'm going to show you some examples of this in a moment. Tolkien, in order to clarify this, he says this is actually a borrowing in time. You know, borrowing stories in time, generation after generation. So we have independent invention, we have inheritance, and the last one is this. Some of you know this Norman Rockwell painting. I've always loved this. In fact, I got to use my laser pointer. I've always loved these characters right down here. Because this is gossip being spread. These two are the same, and it gets down to, look at this guy right here. He says, pointing at him and stuff. And then it gets back to her, that she's the one who told the gossip. It has nothing to do with my point, beyond the fact of... It's a good representation of what Tolkien calls diffusion. So independent invention, inheritance, and then number three is diffusion. And this is what it looks like. He says where inheritance is actually borrowing in time, diffusion is actually borrowing in space. So what happens, especially when you're dealing with an oral tradition, is you hear a story and you don't stay put. not only do you hand it down to your kids who are living in the same house, but you go to your neighbor. And guess what? Your neighbor travels to the next village. And there's a guy in the village who hears that story who actually travels to the Far East. And that's how we get stories like Little Red Riding Hood over in China. How is that possible? Right? Diffusion. Diffusion and inheritance depend on an oral tradition. Now, one of the risks that you have when you do have an oral tradition is the stories don't remain the same. They change over time. They're limited by human memory. And what you'll do is you'll actually be reading a story, for example. You'll be reading a particular fairy tale, and it'll start one way, and then you'll read it, and you'll say, wait a second, am I reading Beauty and the Beast here? And then you'll go on, and that's because stories over time and over space collide into one another, and they take on those features. And it's not just the fairy stories themselves. Last night, I was talking about fables with a group of teachers. And Aesop himself, according to legend, he came in to Delphi and told a story to the Delphians. They didn't like it. So what did they do? They hid a silver cup in his satchel and accused him of stealing it. Does that sound familiar? The Old Testament story, right? Those kinds of stories occur frequently in these fairy tales. So as you read them, you'll be surprised about these things. This morning we talked about the goose girl, right? And the story of Nathan coming out to David. You are the man who killed Uriah, right? And that came up in the goose girl. All right. Let me show you an example of this, a concrete example. One of the most well-known Aesop's fables is the tortoise and the hare, right? You can go way back and it's part of the tradition. Now, I'm not convinced that Aesop he didn't write it, but he didn't come up with the story because we just don't know. But it's part of the tradition that we call Aesop's fables. And of course, you know the story. Slow and steady wins the race, right? The tortoise actually beats the hare. Well, I told this story last night, and I'll tell it again. There was a guy, an American named Joel Chandler Harris. Joel Chandler Harris was an illegitimate son. He never knew who his father was. He knew who his mother was. She raised him actually in a house behind the doctor's house in the town that he was born. He was ostracized quite frequently while he was growing up. And so one of the places he would go is he would go into the slave quarters. He would sneak into the slave quarters on the plantation, and he would listen to their stories. And he would remember and copy down these stories so that later when he became a journalist, he worked at a number of newspapers, but he ended up working at the Atlanta Constitution here in Atlanta. And he started to publish these stories, and he published them in the dialect that he heard them. At least he put them on paper. And he wrote these, and they became hugely popular. And he wrote them every week, and then he eventually collected them into Uncle Remus tales, this kind of a fictional character. Now, I'm not going to have time to answer this, but here's a question for you to consider. Remus, have you ever heard the name Remus before? Remus is connected with? Why is his name Uncle Remus and not Uncle Romulus? Think about that for a second. We're not going to answer it here, but it's one of those brain teasers. Why is he called Uncle Remus, right? All right. One of the stories that Joel Chandler Harris heard in the slave quarters was a story that eventually he wrote down as Br'er Rabbit and Br'er Terrapin. In fact, this is the illustration from the original edition of it. And it's a very, very similar story. The rabbit, Br'er Rabbit, the trickster, right, claims to be, the quickest, and then Br'er Terrapin, not tortoise, challenges him to a race. And it's a very similar story, but there is a twist to it as well. If you know this story, Br'er Terrapin actually beats him, not because of slow and steady wins the race, because he out-tricks the trickster. And the story actually begins with this. Did you know that all turtles look alike? Can you see where the story's going? He actually gets his whole family involved. So In this story, Br'er Rabbit never slows down. But at every turn in the race, there's Br'er Terrapin, or who he thinks is Br'er Terrapin. And actually, Br'er Terrapin is at the end of the race waiting to cross the line. But it's amazing how similar they are. So how did that story get into the slaves' quarter on the plantation? Did they hear it through European track, or did it come over on the slave ship? There are a number of stories that are similar to this that we have from Aesop that are also in Uncle Remus tales. I'd recommend you take a look at those tales as well. How about this? Here's a list of actually fairy tales. Zeus and Europa, Cupid and Psyche, the girl who married a snake, East of the Sun, West of the Moon, King Pig, the Frog King. I already told you about the Lady and the Lion and the Princess Frog. Look where they're all from. Look where the time that they're from. At least the first two are from ancient Greece and ancient Rome. Do you know this story? Do you know any of these stories? Do you know that at the core of each one of these stories is a story that you know very well? In fact, if you know this story very, very well, and you read those other stories, you'll begin to recognize it. Why is that? The reason is because of inheritance and diffusion. These stories do not stay put. The best ones continue, continue, continue. Now, one more comment about Grimm's. What do you know about the legend of the Grimm brothers, right? Is that they went off into the countryside. They were linguists, by the way, and they were trying to collect stories in order to capture the identity of the German people. So the idea or the story goes, they rode off into the countryside and they collected these stories in taverns around the country, right? Actually, they did do that. They went out into the country to collect stories, but the effort was quite unproductive, and they didn't get the kind of stories they wanted to hear. Believe it or not, they got the majority of their stories from the girls next door, a family called the Wild family. There were four sisters who had heard stories, who told it to the brothers Grimm. They wrote them down, and they published them. So the legend of the Grimm brothers going out and collecting these stories, they actually made their way to them because they lived next to the Wild sisters. So, all right, so what is a fairy story? We already talked about that. What is their origin? Remember, independent invention, diffusion, and inheritance are the three. But the most important question that I have for us today is, what is the use of them? In other words, why on earth should we read fairy stories? And again, we're going to go back to Tolkien for the answers. He says three reasons. He says it's recovery, escape, and consolation. And those are his terms. So we're going to go each one through those because I think they apply to your students and they also apply to you. All right? This is the reason why you should read fairy stories. In that essay, Lewis, on Three Ways of Writing for Children, he says, I now read fairy tales openly, he says early on in the essays. And he says, now being older, I have much more to put in, so I'm able to get much more out of it. So he was a big fan of actually fairy tales. So here we go. Let's start with recovery. This is what Tolkien says. One of the reasons why we read fairy stories is to recover or to regain, he says, regaining a clear view or clearing our windows or gaining fresh attention. In fact, he even gives us a little bit of an experiment. The way to pronounce this word I'm going to show you is morifak. This is the word, morifak. Do any of you know what morifak is? Okay, so this is what Tolkien says in his essay. Morifak is a fantastic word, but it could be seen written up in every town in this land. It is coffee room, written backwards, right? Isn't that great? He actually provides the experiment on the point he's trying to make, is that by seeing this word in a little bit of a different way, it contained a little bit of magic to it, right? But as soon as you know what it is, the magic is gone, right? Watch this. He says this, coffee room viewed from the inside through a glass door as it is seen by Dickens on a dark day in London. He's referring to an episode when Charles Dickens went into was in this shop, and he looked at this window and saw this magical word, morifak, And he thought, what is this word? Why don't I know this word? And then the door swung closed and he goes, oh, it's coffee room, right? Now, I will tell you this. You may have experienced this. Have you, and I know I'm taking a risk here, have you ever gone up to a mirror and you've been looking at yourself in a mirror and then you look at the room behind you in the mirror and it's 180 degrees opposite, right? So you look in it and it has a strangeness to it. If you haven't done it before, do it. Maybe do it in your hotel room. Look in the mirror. And now, actually, authors have used this to great effect. George MacDonald wrote a story called Fantasties, and in the middle of it, he tells this short story of a student who wants to buy a mirror, and there's a woman, when he looks in the mirror, it's the same room behind it, but the woman is in the mirror, but when he turns around, she's gone, and he wants to know and love this woman. So George MacDonald uses this to great effect. Try it. It's eerie. But in fact, put it up in a room that has a lot of objects that you know very well, and look in the mirror, you go, I forgot there was a plant there, right? Why? Because you walk by the plant all the time. You get so used to it. But seeing it from a different angle allows you to see it and actually recognize it. This is what Tolkien says further on. He says, as we use by Chesterton to denote the queerness of things that have become trite when they are seen suddenly from a new angle. These things that we get so used to looking at, we no longer see them. So that's recovery. Fairy tales give us an opportunity to recover our vision, to clear our lenses and to see things. Remember what happens with the natural world, right? The rules of the natural world in terms of the material world change. And in changing those, it allows us to see perhaps the most important things, like the virtues, for example. Those don't change, but by changing the context around, it allows us to focus in on them. Recovery. Next one is escape. Now, what's important to understand here, and this is a common criticism about literature in general, but fairy tales in particular. Oh, don't read those. That's just escapism. And actually, Tolkien takes this head on. He says, we are not talking about escapism. We're talking about escape. And they're two different things. What he says is this. He is promoting the idea of the escape of the prisoner. And he says, how could you blame someone who is unjustly imprisoned for wanting to escape? Right? What he is not talking about is what he calls the flight of the deserter. This is what he means. We create these processes, these habits in our lives, and they're legitimate. If we didn't have schedules, if we didn't have habits, we wouldn't be able to do all the things we need to do. But what fairy tales give us an opportunity to do is to escape out of that world momentarily. But it's not desertion. It's not escapism. I don't want to deal with my problems, so I'm going to go and escape into this fantasy world. If you live in the fantasy world, that's a problem. And Tolkien would agree with that. But fairy tales give you a momentary opportunity to escape out of that world and to be able to catch your breath. I tell my students every once in a while, you just need to slow down and you need to take a deep breath. In fact, there are a few of my students in here who I had at Hillsdale, and I tell my students this every year. I say, guess what? The sun came up today, and you most likely missed it, right? Why? Because you've become so used to seeing it come up, and I tell them, guess what? It's going to set tonight. It's a clear night. Don't miss it. In fact, I said this last night. I'll say it again. We have a rule in our house that anytime between around 5:30 to 9:30, depending on the time of the year, anyone in the house can yell sunset, all right? And we live on a hill, and we look west, and we have a beautiful view of the sky, of the western sky, and anyone in the house can yell sunset, and everyone has to stop and look and turn and look, almost like a cult. No, I'm just kidding. Look at the sunset, and we have one additional allowance is that if you are in arm's length of a light switch, you can turn off the light. But you just have to sit there and just luxuriate in the glory of God, right? To be able to do that. But yet, This happens every single day. And we miss it. Why? Because we've lost our ability to see. We've lost our ability to pick our head up and go beyond these processes and habits. All right. C.S. Lewis says it this way. And once again, it's a great essay. He touches on a number of things. It's relatively short. It's about 6 pages long or so. But as true to Lewis, he's going to touch on a lot of things. This is what he says. It would be much truer to say that fairyland arouses a longing for he knows not what. It stirs and troubles him, and then he puts in parentheses, to his lifelong enrichment. In other words, it's good for him, right? With the dim sense of something beyond his reach. And this is the important kind of inserted clause, far from actually dulling and emptying the actual world, right? It doesn't make the actual world worse or make it dull. Gives new dimension of depth. He does not despise, and this is the well-known quote from this essay, he does not despise real woods because he has read of enchanted woods. The reading makes all woods a little enchanted. Chesterton put it this way, as long as we view a tree as an obvious thing, we cease to wonder at it. Only when we recognize a tree for what it is can we go, that's incredible, right? That's what fairy tales do. Last but not least, consolation. These are the words that he uses to describe consolation. It is the joy of the happy ending. He actually coined a new term. So if you've heard the term eucatastrophe, it comes from this essay. It's the good catastrophe. The sudden joyful turn, a sudden and miraculous grace, a piercing glimpse of joy. He says, in a fairy tale, it seems as though all is lost. And then all of a sudden, there's this moment of pure joy, and the story ends. Now, you've seen this many, many times. It usually comes in the form of happily ever after. That's eucatastrophe that comes at the end of the story. So let me give you an example from Rapunzel. And this is Paul Zielinski's illustrated edition. He actually won the Caldecott Award for this. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. I'd highly recommend it. But you can see Rapunzel, and you know the story of Rapunzel pretty well. She's trapped up in the tower by Mother Gothel, right? And she's trapped up there all alone. And the prince comes by and hears her singing, right? And he learns the trick of how to get up into the tower, and he goes up into the tower, and the prince and Rapunzel are together. She's a little bit alarmed at the beginning, as you can see in her eyes, but he's immediately in love, and they both actually fall in love. Now, this is a little bit of an interesting thing if you know the history of this story. In the first edition of it, there's no mention whatsoever of them getting married. Now, that's important when you come to the end of the story, but in later editions, there's references to and she put her hand in his, and they were married. So they realized that these stories were going not to an adult audience, but to a children's audience, and they realized they needed to kind of sanction the relationship, you know, by including this. So you can actually see in his illustrated copy here that she putting her hand in his as a symbol of they were married. Well, as would happen, though, Rapunzel makes a mistake, right? Now, again, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but in the original edition, it was a slip of the tongue. Actually, in further editions, it was. But in the original edition, she says this. She says, Mother Gothel, why is my dress getting so tight? Right? In other words, she was with child. And immediately, Mother Gothel knew, the prince. It's the only way that she can be with child is that the prince came up. In later editions, the second and onward, she says this. She goes, why are you so much heavier to pull up? Or why is the prince so much heavier to pull up than you are? And a Mother Gothel realizes it right away and realizes what's been going on behind her back. So she gets Rapunzel, she cuts her hair, and she banishes her out into the wilderness, right? The hero of our story, she's banished out there. Not only that, she uses Rapunzel's hair and puts it on a hook. You can actually see it up there. And the prince, thinking that Rapunzel is up there, climbs up the ladder only to discover Mother Gothel is there. And she confronts him and calls him wicked, and he falls from the tower. And there's two versions of it. He either impales his eyes on a thorn bush, or most likely he goes blind from the fall itself. But not only does he become a blind, but he's also has to wander in the wilderness. And it's really interesting, for 7 years. We talk about this in my class. The number 7 comes up frequently in this. But even look at the image itself. I mean, the prince is wearing his clothes, but look at the colors in the image, right? This is despair, his hand over his blinded eyes, wandering in the wilderness for 7 years. And then you catastrophe. In his wandering, he encounters Rapunzel, who's also in the wilderness. In addition, is with their two children right here. You can see in the corner in another cave. And her tears from her eyes drop into his eyes, and they allow him to regain his sight. How does this happen? It doesn't matter. It's the fact that it did happen. That's the eucatastrophe. That's the magic, right? Don't break the magic. Don't ruin the magic. They're reunited, and they return to his home kingdom, and they live. There you go, right? That's eucatastrophe. That's what Tolkien is actually talking about. And as I'll show you in a minute, he says that this is an essential component of a fairy tale. Let me give you one more example. A wonderful paragraph to show eucatastrophe. And it's clear that Lewis knew this concept and knew it well. And he knew that he was writing a fairy tale as well. In fact, he wrote, not a defense, but an explanation of the Chronicles of Narnia, where he actually refers that he was drawn to the form of the fairy tale. This is what he says, or this is what it says, the last paragraph. And as he spoke, he no longer looked to them like a lion. But the things that began to happen after were so great and beautiful that I cannot write them. Doesn't that sound a little bit like Tolkien? Listen, I'd love to tell you about it, but you can't capture it in words. And as for the end of all the stories, and we most truly say that they all lived happily ever after. That's in the text. But for them, it was only the beginning of the real story. All their life in this world and all their adventures in Narnia had only been the cover and the title page. Now at last they were beginning chapter 1 of the great story, which no one on earth has read, which goes on forever, in which every chapter is a better than the one before. Tolkien makes a theological argument here as well. He says that consolation is an echo of the great consolation of eternity, that those who know Christ will live in eternity happily ever after. And he says that this echo of consolation throughout these stories is an echo of a greater eternity, which is pretty powerful as well. This is what Tolkien says in his essay. He says, almost I would venture to assert that all complete fairy tales must have it, referring to eucatastrophe. In other words, it's an essential element, according to Tolkien. All right, let's talk about some of the features of a fairy tale. We already know two of them, right? Now, I'm going to break them up into essential features and then common features. So the essential features are two. We have them, magic and eucatastrophe. A true fairy tale, according to Tolkien, has to have magic of some sort, fairy, right? And then eucatastrophe. So immediately, if you know your Grimm's tales, you're thinking, I know a lot of stories in the Grimm's canon that do not have happily ever after. Well, then Tolkien would say, well, then you're dealing with a folk tale or something else, but that's not a fairy tale. It has to have happily ever after. In fact, a lot of the Grimm's tales are folk tales. They don't necessarily include magic, right? But they're just stories that have been told over time, in that particular case, through the German people. So those are the two essential features. Now, those aren't the only features. Let me identify some common features of these stories as well. So, for example, once upon a time. that's kind of a marker that you're going to be reading a fairy story. It's not a requirement, but it's a common marker, and you'll see this all over the place. And I'm sorry, but I keep going back to Narnia because many of you know Narnia. Do you know how the Chronicles of Narnia began? And by the way, we're not going to have the argument about Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe or Magician's Nephew. You're not up to it. No, I'm just kidding. Let me just say this once again. The Chronicles of Narnia begins with the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and it begins with these words. Once there were four children. Now, you don't have once upon a time there, but the word once, he's signaling again that he's going to be writing a fairy tale. And it triggers in your mind, okay, we're dealing with a fairy tale here. So one of the common features is once upon a time, but it doesn't have to be there. People. Now, you might think that this is crazy, but remember, a fairy tale is not necessarily about fairies, all right? They can be in there, but it's not a requirement. But more often than not, it includes people. In fact, Chesterton says this, there can be no good fable with human beings in it. That's a fable. There can be no good fairy tales without them. Now, a fable is typically a shorter story, and its essential element is that it has to have a moral to it, right? And the point is we're going to tell you a short story, and we're going to key in on a particular moral. And we're not going to be distracted by things like personality in order to do it. I'm going to pick a tortoise and a hare. I'm going to pick the fox and the grapes, and I'm going to nail one specific virtue or vice in this, because we don't want personality to cloud it out. Fairy tales are different. They're typically a little bit longer. Some of them are very long, but typically they're longer. And we want readers to associate with the characters in a personal way. If you were on my presentation earlier, you realize that one of the reasons why kids connect to these stories so well is that they see themselves in these stories, but more often than not, they want to emulate those characters in that story. And you can only do that if there's people there. That's very different from the fables. Tolkien himself says this, most good fairy stories are about the adventures of men in the perilous realm. So although it's a fantastical world, it's men encountering this world. Yes, there could be ogres, there could be elves, there could be lots of different things, but typically you'll have men show up in these fairy stories. All right, not many more, hold on. So once upon a time, people and royalty. Do you ever stop to think how many fairy tales begin with something like, once upon a time there was a king, right? So we see kings, queens, princes, princesses. Why is that? Why is royalty not an essential component, but a common component of these? Well, let me show you an example. The Princess and the Goblin, I would highly recommend it, George MacDonald, and it begins like this. There was once, or once upon a time, right? There was once a little princess whose father was a king over a great country full of mountains and valleys. Notice in this, princess and king, right? Right off the bat. Now, George MacDonald's Princess and the Goblin was published originally as a serial. In other words, it came out month after month in a publication and that he was the editor of. And he released a chapter by chapter by chapter, and eventually it was compiled into a whole book. This is how Treasure Island came out. This is how Pinocchio came out. They all came out like this, and they were eventually compiled. This is what you'll see in the book. When he originally published it in 1872, I'm going to read you the original introduction that he had. You can find this online. This is the original opening to The Princess and the Goblin. He says this. Now watch how close it matches. There once was a little princess who, and then it breaks right there. And actually someone interrupts him. So I'm going to call this person the interrupter. The interrupter says, but Mr. Editor, why do you always write about princesses? And MacDonald responds, because every little girl is a princess. Now some of you are saying, aw. The others of you are saying, oh my gosh. here we go again, right? Well, hold on. This is what the interrupter says. You will make them vain if you tell them that. Isn't that what some of you were thinking? Oh my gosh, can't tell them that all the time. You'll turn them into vain. And then MacDonald responds to the interrupter and he says this, not if they understand what I mean. The interrupter says, then what do you mean? And then MacDonald turns the question on the interrupter and says, what do you mean by princess? And the interrupter says, the daughter of a king. And then MacDonald says this, very well, then every little girl is a princess. And there would be no need to say anything else except that she is always in danger of forgetting her rank and behaving as if she had grown up out of the mud. I have seen little princesses behave like the children of thieves and lying beggars, and that is why they need to be told, or maybe reminded, that they are princesses. And that is why when I tell a story of this kind, I like to tell it about a princess. Then I can say better what I mean because I can give them every beautiful thing I want her to have. And then the interrupter says, go on. In other words, tell the rest of the story. This was eliminated, as I say, in the book, and probably it was eliminated because the message of that opening is throughout the entire book. He's writing a book about princesses because he wants to remind these children, you are a child of the king, right? That's why they need to be reminded and they need to be told, you are a princess, all right? Another example comes from Pinocchio. This is a wonderful illustrated edition. It's also in English by Roberto Innocenti. He's an Italian illustrator, beautiful illustrations. The original story is by Carlo Collodi, and he is going to use these common features of a fairy tale to kind of get you going in one direction and pull you in the other. This is how it actually begins. Once upon a time there was, and then he stops, a king, my readers will shout together. Now, isn't that interesting? He uses once upon a time, in other words, telling his listeners, I'm going to read you a fairy tale, right? So they know. And what's the response? Even before he gets to say it, they jump to the conclusion, it's a king. Fairy tales are about royalty, right? And then he uses that and twists it. He says, no, children, you make a mistake. Then he starts all the way back at the beginning. Once upon a time, there was a piece of wood. In other words, I'm going to tell you a fairy story, but this is a fairy story of a different kind. Now, ask yourself this. Why do fairy tales deal in royalty? Maybe royalty is an example of the best version of ourselves, right? Now, that's lost in our American culture where we have a skeptical eye of royalty, right? But these stories are very, very old. And oftentimes, kind of like the headmaster in a school, we look as an example of what we should be. Oftentimes, that was the case with royalty as well. You look to royalty to say, that's the best version of ourselves. Now, they didn't always live that out, but that was the idea. All right, I need to move on. Titles, but not names. All right, now, in The Princess and the Goblin, it's a longer story. We learn about Curdy, Irene, Ludi, all these characters. But in shorter stories, typically it's just the king or the queen or the princess. Things are very black and white. Good versus evil, true versus false, beautiful versus ugly. It's obvious who the evil character is. It's obvious who the good character is. It's interesting in our modern twisted fairy tales, like Shrek, for example, just take the characters in Shrek, and you can almost see how the common characters of nobility and royalty and the other characters, the ogre, the dragon, and the donkey, it's been flipped on its head. And there are consequences to that, right? But we don't have time to talk about that right now. But in fairy tales, it's very cut and dry. Who's good, who's evil? And it's very obvious for the reader to see. This is what Garoyan says. Fairy tales say plainly that virtue and vice are opposites and not just a matter of degree. There's complexity in life and there's complexity in literature, and that's coming. But for kids, they need to see stories where it is much more black and white. Now, this is almost the end. Here are some well-known authors I thought that I would just give you. Charles Perrault, the Brothers Grimm, Hans Christian Andersen. Many of his tales people will call original, but you can find elements in those where they're not necessarily original. George MacDonald, Andrew Lang, the great compiler, and believe it or not, Oscar Wilde. I told the group last night, I gave them The Selfish Giant at the end to read. That is an amazing story with deep, deep Christian elements in it, explicit Christian elements in it. And at times it's hard to believe that that story came from Oscar Wilde. So his fairy tales are quite good. All right, I think I've come absolutely to the end. I just want to say thank you for being in this very warm room and to hear me just talk on. So thank you. Enjoy the rest of the conference. So thanks.